Meeting to order. Welcome, everyone. We will start today with a public hearing on House Bill 3459. Council.
Chair Boyd, members of the committee, House Bill 3459A adds motor vehicles used in construction to the definition of motor vehicles for the purpose of motor vehicle franchise law. In 2003, the legislature amended the vehicle franchise statutes, and the legislation included a new definition of motor vehicle by limiting the definition of vehicles to vehicles used on a public highway. Construction equipment was not included. Previously, such equipment or such vehicles were included in the definition of motor vehicles. So House Bill 3459 puts the definition back in to motor vehicles. This bill passed out of the House with a unanimous vote.
Okay, and Council, we have an A2 amendment to this?
Yes, you do. I'm sorry. The A2 amendment specifies that the bill applies to motor vehicles ordered, purchased, or delivered on or after the effective date of this act, and not just motor vehicle franchise agreements entered into or renewed on the effective date of this act.
Okay, thank you. And we have signed up Mr. Martinez and Jeff Simonson. Welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Thank you.
You almost let the House take over here. I got here in the nick of time.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Tim Martinez today here on behalf of the Halton Corporation, the Caterpillar franchisee from Portland. First, I want to thank Representative Ackerman and the Chair for allowing us to go first. I very much appreciate that. With me is Jeff Simonson from the Oregon Machinery Dealers Association. We will be brief. The Council did a good job analyzing the legislation. What happened in the last session was the franchise statutes were rewritten on behalf of the Automobile Dealers Association. Inadvertently, folks like Mr. Halton's corporation were left out. This simply puts them back in. I believe the representative from the auto dealers is here in the room and in support of this legislation as well. The Dash 2 amendments seek to replace Section 2 in the engrossed bill to make it very clear what products we're talking about and when they become effective. Because as I understand it, as Jeff will tell you, the franchise agreement he has from his manufacturer goes back to 80s. I understand Mr. Halton's franchise agreements goes back to the 40s. So these things are not renewed. They're just signed and go into place. And the language in the Dash 2 amendments is identical to what was in 604 last session. So we believe they will solve our issue well, and we'll be happy to answer any questions. And if not, I will turn it over to Jeff for some brief comments.
Hi, Jeff Simonson, President of the Oregon Machinery Dealers Association. We have about 30 members that are dealers in Oregon, representing probably about 4,000 or 5,000 employees. Almost all of these dealerships are family-owned. Each of these families have several million dollars of their personal assets invested in these families, or into these businesses, I'm sorry. And as Tim had mentioned, most of these businesses have been awarded franchises in excess of 20 years. I can think of only two that are in less than 10-year time period. Each year, these businesses are required to spend tens of thousands of dollars in training of their salespeople, their mechanic force, and so forth to keep up to date with the manufacturer requirements. And it's just very important to each of these family businesses and the employees that rely on them to know that these franchises are going to stay in place year after year, providing that we meet the standards that the manufacturers placed before us.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Fuller, you're back there in the audience. You're not signed up. Is there anything you want to add to this discussion? Okay. Committee, this is a pretty straightforward bill. I'd like to move it today unless I hear a major heartburn. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3459 and open a work session on House Bill 3459, and we have a Dash 2 amendment.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3459.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 3459. Are there any questions?
House Bill.
House. Oh, did I say Senate Bill? Oh, my goodness. House Bill 3459A. Got it? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move House Bill 3459 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3459 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. I will carry this bill. Thank you. Okay, now we will start the Ackerman agenda. Thank you again, Representative Ackerman, for your patience in allowing this to move forward. We will start with a public hearing on House Bill 2545.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bob Ackerman. I'm a state representative from Legislative District 13, North Eugene. I'm here today as a chief sponsor of House Bill 2545. This project started out with the original bill, which was going to disallow any charges for legal costs and the assembly of public records at the request of citizens under the Public Records Act. It was primarily a response to an ad where I made a public records request. I got somewhere around 36, 37 pages, I remember now, and the bill was over $800. So it led me to inquire why the bill was so high, and I found that it was because the agency was assessing legal costs with respect to my complaint, or excuse me, to my request. After I dropped the bill, it became apparent to me that the state agencies did need some leeway to charge legal fees for public records requests. It was my goal to try to narrow that as possible as quickly as I could, as carefully as I could. We heard we had a couple of work sessions and talked particularly with people from the court system and from corrections that get a lot of records requests from prisoners and inmates that are extremely broad and varied and complicated. And we also heard from the small special districts that don't have a lot of legal staff, a lot of resources available for this. We also heard from the legal work in cities and other associated groups in trying to get a compromise so that they would have a reasonable basis to define what they could charge for and what they could not charge for. So what we identified in the last version of the bill through the Dash 3 amendments is that attorney's fees could be charged by the public body for first a reviewing the records, redacting material, and segregating records into exempt and non-exempt records. In support of that, I thought that these were the preliminary legal steps that one would have to take if there were questions about releasing the document. Obviously, it would take some legal review. It might take some redacting where you had issues of confidentiality, which would involve a legal judgment by a lawyer, and also the segregating of public records into exempt and non-exempt. If you remember the public records law, there's two basic categories of exempt records, and each category has about 30 subparts. So in analyzing those, in doing that work, we thought that did involve very specific legal judgments. Beyond that, the agency could not charge for legal time in determining the application or the scope of the statute with respect to records request. We thought that was reasonable. We also added on a provision that if the fee for any of the costs charged by the agency is more than $25, they'd have to provide the requestor with that information so that the requestor could be advised of what the costs were. And if they were too exorbitant or too large, they could probably tailor the request to make it bring down the request and bring down the charges. Under the current situation, there's just no notice at all. In my situation, I was sort of blindsided to get a bill for over $800 for 30 pages with no upfront opportunity to discuss that or negotiate it with the agency. So this is a compromise, I think, of what we thought in the House was the best thinking on this particular problem, and we urge you to take a good look at it and forward it to the Senate floor.
Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. Representative Ackerman, you testified that a Dash 3 amendment about a Dash 3 amendment, but I'm reading your testimony, and on the back page it says that this writing I'm negotiating a Dash 1 amendment. So did I not hear you correctly, or is there another amendment?
I thought the final bill was one other dash three amendments. I could be wrong. I'm just looking at the Ann Gross bill now, and I can't piece that together. However, the representation is correct. I can't remember why the dash three came about. Oh, I thought that was the one that was in the Ann Gross bill.
So, Madam Chair, I just want to be clear, Representative, that there is no amendment up here for us to look at.
No.
We're looking at the bill as is, the Ann Gross version.
That's correct.
Okay.
I was reading off the dash three, which is in the Ann Gross bill.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
You know how I take notes. I just wanted to be sure my notes comported with your notes.
That's okay. I do that to witnesses, too.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Representative Ackerman, did you have any discussion when this was in the House about page 2 of the Ann Gross bill on line 5 where you talk about the $25 fee? We know that agencies are uniformly overjoyed to comply with public records requests.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any discussion about if someone does come to you with a very large bill and notifies you, and is there any sort of process that you discussed to kind of challenge some of those charges so that you could still get your records?
Not in this bill, because if you read further on in the Act, there is a provision where charges could be waived by the agency, and I thought that was probably adequate protection. I also feel that if the bill's under $25, you're notified about it, then you can make that challenge immediately. And I know that when I made that challenge to my records request, I found out that they were charging me, yes, $28 an hour for the administrator to locate the file and to assemble the file, which I don't think was chargeable, so much an hour for the lawyer to do the file and what he or she did. At least I think with the $25 threshold, most people are going to understand what they're getting and what they can negotiate for.
So if they do come back with something over $25, there are other provisions that somebody could challenge them making charges for particular things.
You could request them to segregate the charges, and you could request a waiver.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On House Bill 2545, open a public hearing on House Bill 2547. This time I'll actually let counsel summarize it.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2547 increases from $140,000 to $200,000 the value of estates for which small estate affidavits may be filed. Small estate proceedings are a simplified and streamlined process for probating small estates. The specified dollar amount set in Oregon to qualify as a small estate is $50,000 or less of personal property and $90,000 or less of real property for a total of no more than $140,000. As I indicated, House Bill 2547 increases from $90,000 to $150,000. The minimum amount that may be attributable to real property for an individual to file a small estate proceeding, and that increases the overall value from $140,000 to $200,000. House Bill 2547 passed out of the House unanimously under the consent calendar.
Thank you. Representative Ackerman.
Yes. Chair, we recommend the committee, once again, Bob Ackerman, State Representative from House District 13. This is more or less an update, almost a housekeeping measure. Under our probate code, we can go through a small estate procedure, which is what's involved in this bill, or a formal probate. The advantages of a small estate procedure are that it's much less expensive for the person paying legal bills, and it's also a quicker and more expedient way to probate estates. You could probably get through a small estate. There's a statutory 4-month waiting time, but certainly by the 5th or 6th month you could have the whole probate done. If you're in a formal probate process, it takes longer, it takes more legal time, it takes more involvement with the court. There is, however, a threshold to get into the small estate, and my proposition here today through this bill is to raise the rate for the real property from $90,000 to $150,000, and keeping the $5,000 for the personal property, so that the threshold for a small estate would be one that could not exceed $200,000. The driving force behind the amendment is the fact that I received some correspondence and communication with probate lawyers that say because of the inflationary cost of real estate, more and more estates that could be handled as small estates are now being handled as formal estates. It's taking a little bit more time at more expense to the primarily to the heirs. So the last time the statute was amended was in 1991, and again, because of the inflationary aspects of real property, we feel this is a reasonable adjustment.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Nobody else has signed up. Anybody else want to talk? Nobody else wants to talk. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2547. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2548. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 2548 mandates arbitration in circuit court proceedings in matters for $50,000 or less. Currently, circuit courts may choose whether they want to make arbitration mandatory for suits involving $25,000 or less or $50,000 or less. House Bill 2548 would require the courts make arbitration mandatory for all cases involving $50,000 or less. This bill passed out of the House unanimously under the consent calendar.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman.
Again, members of the committee, Bob Ackerman, state representative from House. Counsel is correct that there's a two jurisdictional limits for what we call court-annexed arbitration. The first is automatic limit of $25,000. That is, if the claim is under $25,000, it's automatically referable to arbitration. Each judicial district, each circuit court, can raise that to $50,000, and what we're doing is raising it from 25 to 50 across the board. Most districts have already reached the $50,000 threshold. The lone holdout are my friends in Lane County, and I wanted to share a few of my experiences with you regarding court-annexed arbitration. As I said, it applies to all filings which are asking for $25,000 or less, or in certain domestic relations proceedings where there's no children or support involved, it's just a division of property. Typically what happens is that you have the choice of an arbitrator. The arbitrators are lawyers that signed up for that purpose. There's a computer system that chooses the arbitrator. There's an advanced and accelerated discovery. It's very, very easy to get documents to the arbitrator and marked and into the record. When you go to the hearing, most of the issues can be stipulated to. There's no jury, of course. And you can get through the smaller cases relatively quickly. My last arbitration in Lane County Circuit Court was an automobile case that would have taken 2 days in circuit court with the formalities of the jury trial and opening statements and arguments and instructions. And I got through the entire arbitration proceeding in 45 minutes simply because of our advanced discovery and the fact we had a skilled arbitrator. When I left, I thought I certainly had done something wrong because I was used to spending more time with these types of cases. The point here is that not only is this a convenience to litigants because the cost factors are extremely low. For example, if I want to introduce expert testimony on an issue, usually a medical issue, in the arbitration process, I just have to submit the medical reports. If I'm in a regular court proceeding, I have to call the doctor as a witness. I'm lucky to get off with less than $3,500 for court testimony or more. Or if I want to take his video deposition, the rate is $500 to $750 an hour, plus the court reporter's time, plus the time for producing the audio. So this has a great advantage for some of the smaller claims, and the increase to $50,000, I think, is very reasonable considering the success rate. I have attached some statistics to show you that basically 80% of the time people are satisfied with their awards. Maybe 20% of the time they will appeal into circuit court for a full jury trial, which is their constitutional right. This is a very successful system, and we're just trying to expand it. There's a great saving in judicial time since each of these arbitrations saves the judicial time. If I'm in arbitration for 1 day, I'm probably saving 2 or 3 days of judicial time if that case was otherwise referable to a full jury trial. So again, I think it's just an update, and I think it is a reasonable way for our court system to go, particularly in these difficult economic times.
Thank you. Do you know when the 25,000 threshold was set? How long that's been in effect?
No, in my experience, it's probably been certainly more than 10 years, probably 15 years. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. I should know that. But
so just on inflation alone, you could certainly justify an increase.
That's correct.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Domingo.
I'm sorry I missed part of your testimony. What counties are not doing this?
Lane County is the predominant holdout. I surveyed as many counties as I possibly could, and most of them came back, even the rural ones, with a $50,000 limit. So.
And what's Lane's issue? Okay, you don't put it on the record.
They felt, and I'm speaking for the court, and I've argued with judges for 40 years, and I've argued with them on this one too. They felt the system was being abused, and there were too many appeals going into circuit court, and the defense attorneys, particularly in automobile cases, were using arbitration as a discovery technique. The statistics don't show that, and I think that's a pretty expensive discovery technique to take a case through arbitration and pay for the arbitrator. Why not just request the records and take depositions? I never understood their position.
Madam Chair, just a comment. I mean, I've used the mandatory arbitration system frequently. I think it works very well. From a plaintiff's standpoint, if you don't want to use mandatory arbitration, fine, you just raise your prayer to more than $50,000 and you avoid it. But
that's right.
It's exactly like Representative Ackerman said. You can solve a case in 2 or 3 hours instead of 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2548 and open the public hearing on House Bill 3157. Council.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, House Bill 3157A makes it discretionary for county commissioners to inspect local correctional facilities that are not operated by the county. This bill passed out of the House with a 58-1 vote.
Okay. For this one, you're going to be joined by Anthony Vita. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. Bob Ackerman, State Representative from Legislative District 13. Current law says that our county commissioners mandatorily must inspect and report on jails within the county jurisdiction, even though they may not own or operate those facilities. So under this current law, the Lane County commissioners would be mandatorily required to make inspections of the Eugene City Jail, for example, and write reports regarding the condition of that facility. They feel that they don't want this to be a mandatory duty. This bill makes it discretionary. I think there's also a liability problem that could be avoided, because if they are mandatorily required to inspect these facilities that they don't own or operate, and fail to do so, or don't do the inspection properly, and an incident occurs, they could incur some liability. It still keeps open the question as to who then has oversight over the local facilities if the county went back into a discretionary function. And of course, the answer is obvious. The municipality that owns the facility would have the absolute right to inspect and control its own facility. Likewise, you'd have some stopgap procedures through the discretionary authority of the county commissioners under the bill, and if conditions were bad enough, I suppose the were required a more formal investigation. I believe the district attorney could convene a special grand jury. So this is kind of a housekeeping bill, but it's important to the commissioners that this mandatory duty be converted to a discretionary one.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee?
Comment.
Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we actually had the same bill introduced on our side at the same request of the commissioners. I think what we had, though, I don't know if it was going to be discretionary whenever they did it. I thought it was basically because they're currently required every year to do it, and we had discussions about maybe every other year to just give some flexibility. There are at least 3 city facilities that they, or probably 4 that they review: Florence, Junction City, Cottage Grove, and Springfield has a holding type, and I'm not sure about Oak Ridge if they actually have a holding one or not. And so what they basically have been doing is taking all the county commissioners, or as many as they can get, and doing this circuit every year where there's little to no change at these facilities. And so it seems like it would be advantageous to allow them more flexibility, and whether or not, you know, it should be discretionary at any time, as to not having a requirement. That's something I think a policy we may want to look at, but clearly every year is overreaching.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Mr. Beda.
For the record, Anthony Beda, representing Marin County. Not much more to add from the testimony you've already heard. This was at the behest of the Marin County Board of Commissioners. They dutifully post and do the inspections, not surprise, but on a regular schedule once a year. And so the effect of that is pretty much a dog and pony show where they come in as part of their other schedule to visit that town, Florence, for example, and have meetings with local elected officials once a year. They make the jail inspection part of that scheduled and posted meeting, go and spend an hour or so touring the jail. And after doing that for several years in a row and basically encountering little or no people in detention when they make those visits, and getting to see every year the same clean and prepared kitchen facilities, the beds all made up nice and neat, and demonstrating the security of the cell doors, they have had second thoughts about how valuable that annual role is, and would still like to have the discretion, of course, to do that when needed or as they hear that there could be problems. But to make it part of an annual ritual, it seems to have value at the margins. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Snyder, did you want to make a couple comments too?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we support House Bill 3157 for the reasons already described.
Thank you. Any questions, comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the hearing on House Bill 3157 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3119. Representative Escobal, I understand you are here for this bill.
For the record, Sal Escobal, Representative District 6, here to speak on 3119. Madam Chair, Senators, this bill was brought and actually initiated by me under the request of some county clerks, specifically Jackson and Josephine counties, and when it came on a hearing in the House side, Polk County, I believe, was also there in support of it. This is a permissive bill only. Well, it started out pretty much like a milquetoast bill, and then all of a sudden it started grabbing and getting some opposition from the county clerks themselves. In fact, some county clerks indicated that they were representing the association itself, and that was not the case. The association itself is split on this. And what this bill does, it's permissive and allows county clerks, which in some counties are appointed and or hired, or they're elected. The ones that initiated this bill are elected, so they're willing to stand on what they're doing. As we know, modern technology changes, and it's changed substantially just in our lifetime. Now, what this bill does, it's permissive again. The county clerk has the option to either microfilm or use computer downloads to retain their records. Now, I've had somewhat of a background on microfilming, and I can assure you that microfilming isn't always clear. The clarity isn't always there. I've been told that it lasts 100 years, and I'm not sure of that because it hasn't been around 100 years. But I do know that you can't hardly buy parts for the machines to read them. Very difficult. When I was in the title business for 3 years, 4 years back, we had to buy actually used machines in order to rob parts off the microfilm readers in order to keep our film reading process in place. You're going to hear from people, and I couldn't understand why people opposed this when they didn't really have a dog in the fight, because it is permissive. You don't have to comply. You can continue on your old ways and do your microfilming, because some counties don't have the technology to do it. So that's why this bill was written as it is. But why would you oppose counties that do? That was my real question. The state archivist, of course, opposes it because it's a change, and to him it's unproven. Computers are unproven. The other county clerks that oppose me, that oppose this bill, though, it surprised me. So I get to thinking about it. And so I asked some people, and the only conclusion we had was that there may be some sort of a way that the county commissioners may realize that this can be done and force other clerks to do so. Again, I repeat, this is a permissive bill. Jackson County can save approximately $24,000 per year by utilizing this process. Josephine County can save approximately $8,000 a year. That's a substantial amount in today's society. The rest of the counties, don't know. The rest of the counties can or cannot participate. It's entirely up to them. As for their situation with their own county commissioners, that's between them and their county commissioners. If their county commissioners force them to do computer backup, that's, again, between them and their county commissioners. You're going to hear probably from people saying, this is unproven. This won't last. Well, that's probably what they said about microfilming. That's probably what they said about documentation. Most documentation lasts if it's preserved properly. Same with microfilm, although there's some real irregularities with microfilm in the fact that it's fuzzy. Computerization is not fuzzy. Technology in the computer industry, as we all know, will change every 5 to 7 years. This technology will have to be downloaded again into a different format, which the county clerks are well aware of. But what this boils down to, I think, is choice. Do you want to give your county clerk a choice to either go into the 21st century, or not? That's what this bill is about. Again, it was initiated by county clerks, and I'm doing this on behalf of these county clerks. Do you have any questions?
Thank you. Fender Pazanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, in your discussions on the House side, was there any regarding security or safety of the document? My only concern that I would have is if these are in some type of electronic form, can they be in a form that cannot be rewritten or written over, as compared to having something that, if there was ever a dispute, you'd always have that hard copy to look at to making sure terms have not been changed? That's the only thing. I mean, it makes a lot of sense since you can save money and give me the option. I'm not sure what the opponents are going to say. I have not looked at all the stuff, but my only concern would be the sanctity of that document not being changed sometime in the future to reach something that maybe it didn't.
Madam Chair, Senator Pruzanski, as you know, if we could today take a document and between recordation of that document and the microfilming of it, you could change that document. We know that. If you really wanted to, you could do it. I think you'd have an encryption, and what I plan to do next session is to allow title companies to do online recordation of documents with an encryption code in order for them to have access into a computer bank, and only title companies. I think it's the wave of tomorrow. I guess what I'm saying is, with microfilm, at one day it was a fine replacement. In my opinion today, it's like waging nuclear war with a bearskin and a stone knife. Its day has come, and its day is going. Tomorrow, we will be using computers that are probably substantially different. I remember when I first went to college, I used Fortran for a language, and the computer was about the size of this room and did absolutely nothing. Today, what can we do with a computer? Your clarity of your documents are far superior than microfilming. They will last if your recorder does their job properly. They are stored off-site and stored in the archives, and they do have some ongoing documents. But you would have to scan it at the place of origin, similar to what we're talking about microfilm. You take a document in, as you know, Senator Prusinski, because you're an attorney. You take it in and record that document. That document is then microfilmed at a later time. That's when I'm saying you could change the document if you so desired. The good thing about this is all you have to do now is scan it, put it in an ARB system, download it into a disk, and you have a file on it. Did that answer your question, sir?
I heard the answer, but I'm not sure if it takes care of it. My concern is what protections are there for once the county takes control of that document, it's been recorded, as to what type of backups do they use or would they use to make sure that there wasn't someone that was able to hack into the system and basically alter it from either outside or inside to change the document, as compared to, it seems to me that once you've got it microfished or some other type of copy, it would be more difficult for those changes to occur than through an electronic process, just because of the ease. And I'm just, PDF files, I know for the most part, most of us cannot go in there and change those because we don't have the right software, but you can in fact get write over and you can actually do that. That's the only concern I guess maybe hearing from some of the people that are here in opposition as to what else they may have. I don't know if this was brought up, but that's the only drawback I see, is making sure that the integrity of the document stays intact.
Madam Chair, Senator Prusinski, that would be the same as what we're faced with today, because if I record this document, I stamp it and record it, it's in a recordation mode, I take it back, I scan it. Now, the only way someone could possibly change that is if I had that program available online. That's where I'm getting at in the future, where we have to do encryption codes and firewalls in order to let people from the outside go forth, example, title companies, and record documents electronically, because they're quite capable of scanning it on their end, sending it into a computer, and receiving it on the county end. But that does have some questions on security. The way it is today, it's the same mode that you're using today, whereas you get that document, you record that document in a scanning mode instead of a microfilming mode, and it's the same basic procedure as you're working on today. I believe they even send it to a company that microfilms it accordingly. I know in Jackson County we have the capability of scanning that almost immediately and putting it into a program and downloading accordingly.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Okay. Now we'll have Diana Bradrick, Charles Killian, and Jan Coleman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Diana Bradrick, and I'm the manager of cartography and records for Washington County. Prior to taking that job in November, I was the deputy state archivist for the state of Washington and the project manager for Washington State's digital archives. I'm speaking on behalf of the Clerks Association, but I'm going to let Jan speak more to those issues. From a clerk's perspective, however, I would say that we have a responsibility for ensuring that the legal and historical documents that get recorded will be on record permanently. And I've had 15 years in the land records business trying to ensure that the documents are going to be there 100 years or 200 years from now, they do get researched back to the beginning. So, and it's not only the citizens that live in the county that do the research. They get research statewide, they get research nationally, and they want to be able to pull up that data when they need to access it. I implemented two imaging systems, and I did an online internet site for access to recordings. I also did a pilot project for e-recording before I left Snohomish County in Washington, and then I managed the digital archives project for the state archives. And that experience only reinforced that while we are making movement in the direction of finding good solutions for migrating the data in electronic form so that it can be read 100 years from now, those systems haven't been in place long enough to ensure that the data won't be lost or that obsolescence makes it unreadable. And in Washington, the estimate is that it will be another 5 to 6 years before they will recommend that microfilm be discontinued. The systems are wonderful for access. They do provide clarity of the images. I embrace the technology, and clerks that have put imaging systems in for recording, they understand all of that. But the insurance policy that the data will not be lost are the microfilm systems that they still have in place. And I would urge that we not establish a procedure that allows pockets of potentially lost data. The standards ought to be statewide so that we can ensure statewide we will have all of the data.
Thank you. Questions? Welcome.
Charlie Killian, records analyst with Clackamas County Records Management. To just add, Madam Chair and committee, just to add to this, there's also a ton of other records at the county level that are permanent retention as well. And I think by passage of this bill, it somewhat opens the door for those other public departments to want to go this route too. And there's a danger in that, as Diana has expressed. And with computer systems, the one group that is not represented here today are information technology departments, how they feel about it. I think there's a big onus with them to try to preserve this data for prosperity over time. And when you're talking about a percentage of this stuff that may not make it through data migration, as you upgrade new systems, there's always a percentage of this information, this data, that's not going to carry over. And I think the potential for that happening is far too great at this point in time. The other point I'd like to make is that in many jurisdictions, if we're talking a very tight budget, microfilming or not microfilming as an option is... You may be looking at a situation where that's cut out of the equation when, in fact, it really needs to be in place. I'm sure if you went to some smaller counties, budgetary dollars are very, very tight. So if even though this is a permissive bill at this state, that may be cut out of the equation when it really should be left in.
Thank you very much. Questions? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk. I am also the overall legislative chair for the Oregon Association of County Clerks. I will clarify that the clerks that are here today representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks are doing that as of the majority of the clerks. This issue was brought before our convention, and the majority of the clerks felt uneasy with the fact that they could support it. So we did not elect to carry this as an issue for legislation ourselves, because the majority are still feeling uneasy about this. basically the clerks feel that they are their issue is, as clerks, to preserve the public record. And right now we feel like we're preserving the record not only for our counties but for the state also. In order to do that, we feel like we have to do it by the recognized means of preservation, which right now the only recognized means of preservation are hard copy, the paper itself, or microfilm. And so we feel we have to carry that forward. Right now, I will tell you that I was a certified Novell network manager. I have since let it go, so if you're looking for IT people, I do have some background there. As that person, and also as a county clerk, I feel very uncomfortable doing what is proposed here. And the reason I do is because I've had a lot of crashes in my life. And it's given that those can happen. We have a lot of new ways to do computers now. We have RAIDs and so forth. So things are different from what they used to be, but it still happens. My backup computer went down last weekend. So those things happen. Searches on our computer systems and with digital imaging are much, much faster than anything we could do with books, paper, or microfilm. We will totally agree to that. But searches are not the permanent record. And that's where the difference lies. I could do a much better search, a much quicker search with all the digital imaging that actually most of our counties have today. But if my network goes down, my computers are not accessible. But I can go pull out some microfiche for an index. I can go pull out the microfilm. I can see both of those without the aid of the computer. Okay? So they are a permanent record. Also, we do have new reader printers. These new reader printers are new technology. They do scan the film now, and they, most of them print to laser printers. They can also capture the images onto your computer, and those images then can be faxed or emailed or whatever. But those are new reader printers and new technology that uses the scanning. Most of us clerks today do record. We do digital imaging, and then we export those images to microfilm. So we do have all those technologies in place. Not to say every county does, but I would say the majority of the counties do. Right now, I guess my concern is that there is something to back up the record. I have about 10 years of an index of my commissioner's journal that we are recovering from microfilm with the actual documents because the index was not converted correctly from a mainframe, and it was basically destroyed. So we are going back and converting or recreating that index from the actual microfilm record. So to me and to the clerks that I am representing here today, it makes good sense that we maintain the record on microfilm. We feel it shouldn't be at this point optional because there's history to preserve.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Brzezinski.
I've got a couple of three, Madam Chair. I guess one question is, we've heard from the representative that this is a, let's say, a mixed position that the clerks may have since you had the convention.
That's true.
Could you please tell us, if there was a vote, what the vote count was for the 36 clerks?
I can't tell you for sure what that is, but the majority of the clerks, there were probably maybe a dozen that would like to do this, and that's just an estimate.
Okay. And can you also tell us if this procedure or process is being used anywhere else in the country and any other states for this type of retention of these type of records?
I can't tell you that. Possibly Mr. Turnbull can.
All right. And my last question is, knowing that this is something that may be coming in the future, or will be coming in the future, let's say that, Is this something that maybe we should put something in place now to strive to reach whatever level of authenticity and process for some date in the future, like, say, have something going in effect in 5 years from now or 6 years, getting us to the point of where we're planning for that instead of waiting 5 or 6 years and then trying to make a conversion in a very short period of time?
You know, it's certainly something to look forward to as far as knowing something that you're going to be able to see without technology. That's the process here, is, you know, if all your machines that are the ones that you have to utilize to see this, quote-quote, that's a good question. I'm not sure what that's going to be.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Turnbull will be coming up next, so you can ask the other one to him. Thank you very much. Mr. Turnbull. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Roy Turnbull, and I'm the state archivist. And as you heard, I'm opposed to House Bill 3119. I did bring some visual aids along, hopefully to help me make some of these points. My point is a very simple one. The only media that have the qualities that are necessary for permanent records right now are paper and silver gelatin microfilm. Computer-based data files lack the qualities that are necessary for permanent records. I monitor the profession associations that issue standards that have been approved by the American National Standards Institute on recording technology on a constant basis, and I can tell you that there is no ANSI standard for permanent records using computer-based data files. In fact, I did a little background stuff before this afternoon, and I looked up in the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is a branch of the United States Department of Commerce, in its special publication from 203 on this topic, and I'm going to quote very briefly for you what that says. NIST says, neither optical disc nor magnetic tape is as stable as microfilm or paper. Environmental factors can, in fact, render discs useless in as little as a few days. The importance of ensuring that information can be read by future generations cannot be overstated. Digital media used as recently as 20 years ago are already incompatible with most of today's systems. And as part of my visual aids, I brought along, you know, some digital media that I had lying around my office for precisely, you know, moments like this. And I'm sure you all recognize at least some of these, and I'm not.
I'm having a nightmare now looking at those 4chan 4 punch cards. I'm not. I start off in computer science. I did not end up in it for a reason. And that's those little digital cards.
Madam Chair, you know, it's not an easy task to read these computer-based media today, and it's not an inexpensive one. The standards bodies have issued tons of standards, and I brought some of them along with me today concerning microfilm and imaging technology. And I can provide you with the assurance that when a standard is issued that says computer-based media are acceptable under these circumstances for permanent records, Oregon will be among the first to adopt that standard. but that day isn't here yet. And for that reason, I'm asking you to vote against House Bill 3119. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you for not reading all those files, too.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3119 and open a hearing on our last bill, House Bill 2225. Thank you, Council, for your patience.
No problem. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2225 would establish a standard of review for appeals from judgment in violation proceedings. Essentially, there are two types of appellate review. One is de novo, where the appellate court reviews the facts of the case and determines whether or not it believes that the trial court could have found the defendant guilty. The other standard is that which is used in criminal cases, and that's whether there is sufficient evidence from which a rational fact finder could find the defendant guilty. Currently, there is no specification for the review of violation proceedings. Bless you. And so this would say that criminal standard will be used in appeals involving violations.
Okay, thank you. And we have signed up Mr. Fussner from the Department of Justice. Thank you for your patience.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Fussner. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here on behalf of the department in support of House Bill 2225. I think you've just received a very clear explanation of what the bill does. My only remarks this afternoon have to do with what we hope to accomplish by instituting a uniform standard for appellate review of both criminal convictions and violations, and that is to make a modest but significant savings in cost and increase in efficiency. The reason for that is that when we brief de novo review cases, it's like trying the case all over again in the trial court. We don't put additional evidence on. The facts are those that were introduced in the trial court, but we have to persuade the judges just as much as if they were sitting as the trier of fact in the trial court. And so there's a lot of briefing that delves into the facts very deeply, has to do with the credibility of the witnesses, the exhibits that are used, and it's a time-consuming, lengthy process. It is truly astonishing if you could see some of the briefs that we receive and that we have to respond to in kind in simple traffic cases, in simple little violation cases that ought to take hardly any time at all. These can be 30 pages long of densely reasoned jury-type argument to the appellate courts. There's no real reason to allow that in violation kinds of cases. They are the least serious cases, and in ordinary criminal cases, from murder to the most serious felonies, the defendants don't get a chance to have a whole second trial in front of the appellate court. Under this bill, they would still receive appellate review. It's just that it would be the same sort, in violation cases, it would be the same sort as is now given in criminal cases. And my final point is, I want to be very clear that this bill does nothing to tinker with the burden of proof that's used in the trial courts. The burden of proof is not affected by this bill one bit. It is solely how the appellate courts review violation appeals. With that, I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
How did it get to be that way in the first place? I mean, it sounds backwards to have a more thorough or more comprehensive review for a violation than for a more serious offense.
Chair Burdick, the way it got there is quite murky, and I don't really have a good answer for you other than to say that the Legislative Assembly has not specified what the standard of review is for violation cases. And as a consequence, the courts have sort of evolved their own approach to it. And it is not even entirely clear, frankly, that they are using a de novo review approach. I'm not aware of a case that's ever come out and said that's the standard of review for a violation, but they seem to apply that approach. And consequently, because there is no guidance from the Legislative Assembly, and because the courts seem to be using this standard, we feel that we, in order to adequately represent the people of the state and the appellate courts, we have to brief these cases that way. Under this bill, it would be explicit, and the appellate courts would be bound by it, and so we would be able, both sides, not just the state, but the other side, would be able to brief these cases knowing what the standard is.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fussman, I guess I just want to put this on the record. Y'all probably went through this on the House side. But my only concern is that you have, I guess I'm going to say, two types of de novo appeal or review. And I'm going to use an example when you have a municipal court and you have either a violation that goes before that court that's tried as well as a criminal matter that's tried. Those defendants do, in fact, have a right to de novo appeal through the circuit court. And what I'm assuming from what I'm hearing from the testimony, we're not talking about that level of a de novo appeal, but the appeal that would come from the circuit court on up to the appellate court. And if we can just get that on the record, and I don't know whether or not the way it's written currently, if it's explicit enough, because my only concern as a prosecutor, it'd be great to be able to have people do de novo appeal to the trial court that's not a full-fledged another trial, but I don't think I'm going to get that option.
Chair Burdick and Senator Prozanski, you're absolutely correct in your understanding of what this bill would affect. It is not intended to, and I don't believe it does, affect how cases go from a municipal court to a circuit court where there is a genuine trial de novo with new evidence being presented. It's a whole new trial and the witnesses are all called again. This is intended to, and I think is limited in its the way it's written now, solely to once you've had that happen in the circuit court, and then the appeal goes to the appellate court, the Oregon Court of Appeals, or potentially the Oregon Supreme Court, where there never is a de novo trial where you call live witnesses. It's what we call de novo on the record, meaning the evidence is what was received in the circuit court, and it's a question solely of how do the appellate judges review that evidence.
Thank you for getting that on the record. Some places don't have municipal courts and others do, so it's good to know how it will affect those. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to talk on this? Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2225. And I don't believe we have any more business today, so we will adjourn Senate Judiciary. Thank you, committee.